Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello and welcome to The Salon. Our guests today are Brandon LaBelle and Konstantinos Thomaidis, who write extensively about the cultural politics of sound and voice. Following a few brief research interactions in the past, they engage here in their first Viva Voce exchange. Brandon LaBelle is an artist, writer, and theorist working with questions of social life, voice, acoustic justice, and agency, and is currently directing the artistic research project Communities in Movement at the Department of Contemporary Art, University of Bergen, in collaboration with Klub Mama Zagreb, AMEE Madrid, and Savvy Contemporary Berlin. Brandon has a long and pioneering history as a writer and editor in sound studies and related disciplines, as well as a maker of performative installations, poetic theatre, storytelling, and research actions aimed at forms of experimental community making. Konstantinos Thomaidis' research focuses on the development of the interdisciplinary field of voice studies. He co-founded and edits the Journal of Interdisciplinary Voice Studies and the Routledge Voice Studies book series, and is the author and editor of many pivotal texts on voice across disciplines, including voice studies and theater and voice. His research work focuses on the notion of listening back, and specifically on methodologies of autobiophony and vocal archaeology, both of which are discussed in this exchange. In this conversation, Brandon and Konstantinos discuss sound and meaning, the performativity of the self in listening and voicing, oral dramaturgies of inclusion and exclusion, and the intersections of history, politics, and voice in James Webb's piece, A Series of Personal Questions Addressed to 5 liters of Nigerian Crude Oil from 2015, and Thomaidis' autobiophonic piece, A Voice Is, A Voice Has, A Voice Does, from 2018. The conversation was recorded on Zoom on the 1st of July 2020 between Berlin, Thessaloniki, and London.
Okay, Konstantinos. Well, here we are. Nice to see you.
Very good to see you. So, are we ready?
I think we're ready.
Right. I don't know, because we have been discussing a lot about, you know, sound and dramaturgy, and specifically and particularly about beginning this conversation. I started thinking about beginnings and beginnings in sound. I don't know, the way my thinking goes is, if we are to talk about beginnings in sound, in voice, and if these beginnings have something to do with oral and aural dramaturgy, personally, I have to begin by admitting that I find beginnings very powerful, but also very awkward. And I don't know if you agree, but they are powerful because they initiate something, particularly in sound. Whatever the semantic content, essentially a beginning tells us that what preceded it doesn't matter. It sort of casts what preceded it, you know, in irrelevance or oblivion, or at least as background noise. And then also it makes promises for the future that something would follow that is a sound, a sonic episode, and that sonic episode has rules and regs because it began in sound. And this is also why I find them awkward, because as a voicer, as a theater maker, I know that a lot of the time these announcements are random, are conventional. They're not in our hands, they're in the hands of the listener, of the perceiver. And also because sometimes, particularly with this sound, if you begin, even though you announce the rules and regs, then sound can go in all sorts of directions and throw the book of rules and regulations out of the way. But I think that the very interconnections of awkwardness and powerfulness lies the fact that a sound beginning or a sonic beginning also initiates a relationship. There is something or someone that makes sound, something or someone that's going to receive it. And the reason why I don't feel too disempowered or too awkward is because this is a conversation. So this is a common, a dyadic beginning.
Yes, no, I think as an artist also, I often have this question about like also how to begin. You know, for instance, if you step into an existing framework or a context and you're sort of in a way called upon to do something, called upon, even as we are here, called upon to perform, then of course, in a way, I always feel like we've already begun with the call. I mean, the call has already started the process. So in a way, we can also think that we're actually not beginning here. We're just continuing with what's already started. So maybe we can enjoy that sense of being in the middle, always already in the middle, which is maybe a kind of sonic position or perspective to think that we're always somehow, I mean, maybe sound in a sense is also something that, of course, there is a feeling of something beginning, but I always have the feeling that I'm stepping into sound, that it's, as we say, a kind of oceanic feeling.
Or in a way that you are invited to step into something mm-hmm. by sound or in sound. Because you mentioned in the middle, I was wondering, what are you in the middle of now in terms of research? I mean, we've read the books, but I do wonder what you have been doing now.
Yes, I could share a few things that I'm in the middle of, or slowly getting towards the middle. There's a couple. One is a sort of research project, an artistic research project that's under the title Social Acoustics, Communities and Movement is the sort of title of the project. And there's different sides to it, but it's based at the Art Academy at the University of Bergen, where I'm working. And essentially the project really, you know, in a very broad sense, looks towards sound, listening, and questions of community, or in a way how sound and listening facilitate or even complicate situations of togetherness, you know, or as you already point to, those relationships that sound makes possible. So this has also led me to the notion that I'm focusing on also in writing that we may call acoustic justice. I've been writing about acoustic justice, extending from that research into social acoustics. In a way, I'm sort of taking the question of acoustics quite directly to think about architectures, to think about environments, to think about the built environment, the acoustic shapes around us that in a way enable sound to occur. So I'm thinking very much less, in a way, less about a sound object and more about the conditions that enable that sound object to take place. So for me, this is a kind of acoustic perspective, an acoustic approach. So then from there, you know, ideas about social acoustics, again, about how, for instance, even the ways in which the voice relies upon certain acoustic parameters or certain acoustic conditions that in a way are also not only physical, but they are also social, they're also institutional, they're also about history and about culture, the kind of acoustic supports that enable, for instance, oneself to speak within certain contexts. So how we in a way find support, how we in a way orient ourselves acoustically and through certain acoustic constructs. This is sort of how I'm approaching acoustic justice and thinking about social acoustics, which in a way then leads me to questions about orientation and also certain kinds of practices. So how do we practice acoustics? Not so much in terms of a design strategy or even as a professional practice, but really as an everyday practice. What kinds of acoustic gestures, acoustic practices, acoustic acts that we make in a way to facilitate or to in a way engage with the ways in which sound is already distributed. So acoustics is somehow also for me about the distribution of sound, the movements and circulations of sound, and of course the meanings that are carried with those sounds. So I'm sort of researching that and then also trying to get into certain practices. So I'm very much thinking also artistically about how to sort of unfold this research. And I'm doing that in a very collaborative manner. I'm trying to create collaborative, collective situations in a range of different contexts and spaces to then, in a way, explore that mode of togetherness, explore modes of togetherness, and again, not think so much about what sounds we are making, but again, what kind of acoustic arrangements are we constructing to enable that togetherness to take shape? And I'm really playing with that in a very speculative manner. So I'm really enjoying also thinking about togetherness in a very experimental, poetic, and speculative manner. So one modality that I'm focusing on now is around the formation or the form of the party. So I'm thinking about parties, social, acoustic, performative constructs through which and within which very unclear and poetic and complex forms of sociality take place. So thinking of the party as a space for community making. So I'm going to be making three parties in Madrid starting in October. So I will be sure and send you an invitation and you can join us for one of the parties.
I would very much hope to do so. And actually, the notion of invitation to a party brings me back to a lot of the things that you mentioned, including orientation, architecture, justice, togetherness, and that kind of invitation that brings you to the party and the sonicity and the acoustic properties of the party, because an invitation is inclusion, but by virtue of including, there is also exclusion, which is such a prime example of togetherness and parting in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's very true. That's part of that complexity that I want to engage with, that sense of the party as a scene of membership, as a space that is in a way, intensely social, intensely territorial sometimes, but that is also in a way always on the way to its own undoing. I'm sort of interested in the party as a space of excess, as a space of festivity, and that can always in a way sort of fragment, be disrupted. You know, it's an unstable sociality, and I sort of want to kind of play with that and explore that, just to sort of think in a way what kinds of community might we find here, or might we imagine, or might we speculate about. So this also made me think very much. I mean, I know you're also very involved with questions about dramaturgy, performativity. So I was curious how you might also think a little bit, or what are you also working on at the moment, Konstantinos?
I have to say that very much in line of what you were proposing, I'm always interested in questions of the community and togetherness, or the vocal in between, who listens, who offers the voice, who dramaturgs the encounter. In the past, I have mostly dealt with the cultural politics of train and how these invitations are embedded in the kinds of sounds that are allowed for a voice to make in different systems of thought and different systems of practices. At the moment, I'm trying to challenge some of my own biases, or let's say inclinations. And as a theatre person, I tend to be preoccupied with the present of the encounter quite a lot. So in order to sort of, help myself think of voice and sound otherwise, I have been developing over the last couple of years a project which I provisionally call Listening Back. So I wonder what kinds of sounds spill over from the past in the present. How do we deal with these sounds? And essentially the project has two strands. The first one, we have sort of started talking a little bit about that, is the notion of autobiophony, It's a project on a vocal autobiography, how we come to have a voice, how our voices are constructs and processes and unfoldings and events rather than one thing. So how do we narrate that story to ourselves? How do we narrate that story to others? And how can we do that in voice and through voice? So this takes the form both of performances and workshops. And secondly, the other strand is dealing a little less with the immediate past and more with pasts that are pre-recording technology. And the questions I'm asking is, how do we retrieve voices that have been considered irrevocably lost? So if the first part I conceived of autobiophony, vocal autobiography, the second one is vocal archaeology. And more specifically, at the moment, I'm listening in to vocality in ancient Greece, because a lot of the research tells us that the musical and vocal parameters have been lost to us. But I'm thinking, but we have a very large archive of other types of documentations. How did voice spill over into these archives and how we can use them to reimagine and perhaps reenact these voices? As you said, a lot of the time we tend to forget that these sounds are co-devised with the ideologies and the perspectives, philosophies on sound. So already through what we know about what was prominent ideologically in ancient Greece about sound and voice, we can start thinking that this was related to the practice of voice. So this is where I am at the moment. And in many ways, you know, listening to some of the sounds that you shared or the ideas that you shared, I felt that this sort of speak to this idea of the personal and the communal, the collective history and how they are co-dramaturged in sound and through sound. I was wondering, would you like to play your sonic cue?
Yes, no, I can come to that. I mean, maybe I just wanted to make a quick response to hearing what you've been working on and this question also of how we listen, you know, to a voice from the past, or how we engage with maybe a vocal archive. Or, I mean, I think it made me, you know, very much think a little bit about the general performativity of the voice and the ways in which, you know, as we know, the ways in which the voice is often called upon to authentically represent oneself or to authenticate oneself through the voice. So how the voice, you know, has this power to really complete me as a subject, or to stand in for me, or to carry me, you know, into the world and into relationships. And at the same time, we know that sort of incredible, uncanny feeling or sense of the voice always being also not me. You know, the voice is also something that, even now as I'm speaking, you know, with you, there's a feeling that my voice is somehow in this media network that is connecting us and that is also being recorded right now for another kind of archive. And so my voice is also not me. It's also separate from me. All these kind of wonderful things that we know about the voice. So it made me think a little bit about how you listen to these voices from the past, or we may project also certain desires or wishes onto the voice, that we want this voice to be something, to either tell us a truth or to tell us something about the past, or to give us access to something, you know, that we can't, you know, find otherwise. So it's also interesting how these voices position us as listeners. Or these recorded voices, we want something with them, from them. They also position us as listeners. So I'm curious about that relationship.
It's very interesting, because I tend to agree with you, and I have to admit I'm rather suspicious of the idea that voice is just a means to authenticity and completing the subject. And as you said, the way the voice performs, I love the phrasing you used, it's also not I, because when I either work in rehearsal or with students, and I teach voice dramaturgy, a lot of the time we dwell on the relationship of the voice to the eye, what it says about the person emitting that voice. And the first step is to start thinking about the listener and what the impact of the listener or the listening situation or the listening circumstance might be on the voice. As you said, the expectation, the desire. And sometimes I like to ask, okay, this is the first person and the second person. What about the third person? The dramaturgy of the third person, what voices? So in this sense, now our dialogue voices, our communication voices, and it speaks masses of the circumstance, the past, and the embeddedness of ourselves in specific, you know, milieus. So in a way, I think you are perfectly right when we, for example, when we talk about the I, the subject or the person and the voice, a lot of the time we hear the it, we hear the desire, we hear what we would like to hear in that voice, or what voice is despite the voice.
Yeah, no, that's a nice perspective, something to think about. Yeah, maybe I can play this audio.
Fantastic, thank you.
Yes. Something to kind of bounce off of a little bit. Maybe I could just introduce it a little bit. This is a work by an artist, James Webb, originally from Cape Town and now based in Stockholm. Well, I follow James's work, and part of his work always or often engages with the voice and situations of listening and also often music. So I was very struck by this recent work. Its title is A Series of Personal Questions Addressed to Five Leaders of Nigerian Crude Oil. So it's an installation up right now in Cape Town. And so it consists of a plinth on top of which is a sort of plexi cube, inside of which is 5 liters of crude oil that taken from Nigeria. And then I think James understands the kind of scenography as a viewer sort of facing the cube of oil, and there being a audio speaker hanging from the ceiling just behind the viewer through which this audio piece is then playing. So one is in a way looking at this cube while hearing this audio behind them. So I'll just play the audio.
The following are a series of personal questions addressed to 5 liters of Nigerian crude oil. I address the oil directly. How close can we stand to you? How honest can we be with each other? How old are you? What was your original form? What can you tell us about the underworld? At what stage will we become like you? When did you first become aware of the connection between progress and catastrophe? What were you doing when Ken Sarawiwa was hanged? What will happen when we die? How can we be good ancestors? What have you been told about your value? Who died for you? What part of you died for us? What is a fair exchange for you, your labor, and your life? How do you suggest we mourn modernity? What does the earth taste like? Where do you end and we begin? What has been disturbed by us, bringing you to the surface? For how long has Ishu been on Earth? How much is left of you? How does this end?
Okay, so that's actually an excerpt. It's a much longer audio. There's around 100 questions, I believe. But it's part of a series that James is doing where he addresses inanimate objects and often in different contexts, sometimes finding these objects in existing museums or bringing an object into a gallery space, as in this case.
This is such a powerful piece, and I immediately want to ask a couple of questions about, first of all, about the dramaturgy, the making of the piece, its inner structure. The first thing that strikes me, and you already started sort of talking about it, is the use of the list as a sonic device. We have a list of questions, and I'm immediately thinking of Umberto Eco, who talks about two types of lists. One is the inventory, the one that has all the items, it's a catalog, and the other one is the poetic list, which is the infinite list, the one that alludes to a list that then carry on going and going. So if we use this sort of as a point of reference, what do you think this piece does? Does it include all the questions, or does it open up to the poetic?
Well, I think, no, that's a wonderful observation or point. I think clearly we're probably on the poetic list in terms of there being an infinite array of questions that one could ask. And it's interesting that James, I think he makes this quite clear in the title of the series. It's always personal questions. He calls them personal questions. So I find it also really, I mean, maybe in this list of questions that in a way attempt to be personal, or that attempt to make a personal relationship with an inanimate object, which I think, you know, absolutely, you know, brings us into a poetic framework in terms of trying to instigate a conversation here. So I think that's quite essential in the work in terms of how do we address an object.
This human, more than human, relationship is fascinating in terms of listening dramaturgy, because immediately through the title and the structure of the piece, you have two kinds of listeners. You have the person who attends the gallery, and then you have the object posited as a listener. So what do you think the piece asks of its listener or its listeners?
No, that's really nice. Yes, there's different positions of listening that the work kind of performatively incites or conjures, making the object a listener. And then in a way, we are sort of eavesdroppers onto this conversation that's happening between the voice and the object. We are sort of placed between those two things in the middle, really. Maybe we're there to witness, to kind of ear witness this imaginary conversation or this poetic framework in which we might begin to hear that object as a kind of imaginary.
And do you think, because I'm fascinated by methodologies of eavesdropping and overhearing or ear witnessing as you posited them, and I didn't immediately think of this when I listened to the piece, but now it makes perfect sense to me. I do wonder, because there's some very personal questions and some, how should I call them, inserts of history, when they ask, what were you doing when Ken Saro-Wiwa, you know, was hanged or was executed? What do you think are the ethics or the politics that come with this ear witnessing in this case?
One of the things that James describes in the work is he talks about the oil representing, is there a way in which we can understand this object as sort of somehow stemming or arising from the psyche of the earth, he calls it, this material that is literally extracted from below, pulled out from the center of the earth, or as James says, you know, from the unconscious of the earth. So what might it tell us about that? It's a carrier of all that geological history. It's a carrier of all those, as we know, economic and political forces that surround it. So I think there's definitely an implied political perspective in the work. But I think James is also really interested to kind of hover around a lot of different areas. So I would, in a way, hesitate to force it to be political, even though quite clearly there's an awareness of the politics around that object that James is working with.
And I think this ambivalence or multivalence is very audible in, what was the question? What have you been told about your value? Which is so individuated and, you know, subject making and at the same time so political, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's as if the object is innocent. It didn't do anything. So, I mean, yeah, it's interesting, as soon as that object gets personified, or it starts to, the address personifies it, or sort of in a way evokes it as a subject, which is very much part of that performativity of the voice, that we can think about the way that it calls us into being. So here, in a way, the address is, you know, kind of conjuring or calling that object into a state of subjectivity.
Yes. Sorry, you were meant.
I only wanted to bring up the idea of the puppet, to think about the inanimate object that speaks, and it often speaks through us, you know, sort of throwing certain kinds of, again, certain desires, or certain, literally throwing the voice onto it, and in a way animating the inanimate by trying to hear what may come back to us.
And in the process of doing that, something I felt was that normally the object is something to be handled or to be assigned value by the human. But in this case, because it was addressed as a listener, therefore potentially as a speaker, as a responder, it could give us the right answers. I started thinking that if I assumed that I know the answers, or if I rehearsed answers on its behalf, I would be wrong. Therefore, I was longing or had a sort of voice envy for the voice of the oil, if that makes sense, because it would know and I wouldn't.
There's also that wonderful 10 seconds of silence between each question, this framework in which we might begin to hear that voice, in which that longing for that voice to appear or to emerge occurs within that silence. You know, so that, I think that silence is also very essential, isn't it?
Yes. How do we emerge from that? And also, correct me, because I think I'm about to cite you. You term these gaps, these pauses that exemplify the longing for speaking as the unvoice, the substratum where voices happen before they're audible, before we break into audibility. And I sort of sense that the gaps dramaturgically operated in this way. Would you say so?
Yeah, that's a nice, yes, I didn't think about that, but yes, absolutely. We might consider the unvoice precisely in this kind of situation, in this conversation that's happening, that sort of submerged voice that is always in a way on the verge of emerging or on the verge of taking place, but stays below or sort of stays under audibility or expression.
And what an engaging way to exemplify that through oil.
Konstantinos, do you want to move on to your sonic cue or the audio you would like to share? Is this a good moment for that, or you'd like to stay with the unvoice?
Yes, I'm happy to extend these questions of the unvoiced, what is voiced or not voiced, or where is agency, where is value, I'll quickly introduce it just because I find this very embarrassing. It's a practice as research piece, autobiophony. It's a performance lecture that I have been performing for the last 3 years called A Voice Is, A Voice Has, A Voice Does. And it includes episodes from how my voice came to be about. Essentially, the piece, the performance lecture, is not about my voice, and I wasn't really interested in that. It was about the audiences participating, because there are lots of participatory tasks into thinking about their own vocal autobiographies. And different vocal episodes reflect on different aspects of that history. And this is one of the final scenes. The piece has 10 scenes, and this is the 9th one. Just before, there were a couple of scenes about surgery and therapy, because I grew up disfluent. The scene just before that was a scene about audible racism and how you're racialized in voice as a foreigner. Because I felt in devising this that I couldn't speak anymore, what happens is you hear this, that you're about to hear, and a recorded voice. So this is roughly how the piece ends. Κινήσου και παρήγγυλα στην πόλη τα μπρικιά σου, στη Βενετιά τα ρούχα σου και τα διαμάντικά σου. Κινήσου κοριτσάκι μου, τη γούσε να νουρίζω και την κουνίτσα σου κουνώ και σε γλυκό κοιμίζω. Hello. Κινήσου και παρήγγυλα. This is Konstantinos' tape recorder. Στη Βενετιά τα ρούχα σου. Konstantinos bought this tape recorder when he was 16. In fact, this is Konstantinos' voice played back to you on the tape recorder. The other voice that you now hear in the space is Konstantinos' grandmother. She sings a lullaby. This is the lullaby that she used to sing to Konstantinos to put him to bed. Konstantinos' grandmother was an immigrant. She came from Asia Minor to Greece in the interwar period, when the Greek population of Turkey was forcefully removed to the Greek mainland. Her family brought with her a rich tradition of songs and music, which all are a mix of Greek and Turkish culture. It's the same with his lullaby. Konstantinos' mother also used to sing this lullaby to him, and she had learned it from her mother, Konstantinos' grandmother. This recording is the only tangible memory Konstantinos has of his grandmother. He was lucky enough to record her as part of her preparation for a show about a year before she passed away. Konstantinos at the time was in the UK, so he didn't manage to say his goodbyes to her. Alongside the recording, Konstantinos in the UK still has a jar of jam that his grandmother made for him and posted to the UK. The jar is still on the cupboard, and there is only a thin layer of jam in it. Konstantinos hesitates to eat it.
every time she opens the jar, she knows there's going to be less and less of the only handmade thing, like his grandmother made for him. As he's recording this, Konstantinos realizes that it's been about 3 or 4 years he hasn't listened to the recording of the lullaby either. He thinks it might be the same reason that holds him back from opening the jar. Perhaps he fears that every time he listens to that voice, the knot that he feels in his throat will become less tight and less tight and less tight until it disappears. How often can you listen to a voice before it starts being less impressionable, less noticeable, before it stops affecting you? Before the body behind it stops touching your own body.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah. There's so many kind of wonderful layers in such a very sort of simple audio collage or audio piece. There's a few things we could unfold. But I was very much struck about this relationship to music that seems to be one of the layers, one of the threads in that narrative. And I find it really so powerful, this sort of ways in which that lullaby becomes a kind of carrier, both of something extremely personal and also something that speaks to a larger cultural, collective, social history, identity. So I find that this is, in a way, maybe we could spend a moment to think a little bit about music in that sense as an incredible sort of emotional archive, something that is so close to us that where we think this melody, this lullaby is really so much for me, it's almost for me, it's so intimate to my experience, while at the same time there's many children, adults singing this melody, singing this lullaby in so many homes and in so many, the way in which it travels, it migrates, and it represents or it captures a cultural community. So I'm extremely, just moved and touched and fascinated by that musical dynamic that you seem to point out in the work.
Thank you very much for this, and especially that last word that you used, dynamic, and just before that, migration. I don't know, the lullaby came about in the piece as sort of resolution, that sense of being very intimate and held sonically. And that had to do with a lot of what preceded this scene. And I wasn't aware of its other functions until the moment I started using it in rehearsal, which rehearsal is a kind of knowledge, a kind of dissection. And when I had to pause it, the lullaby, for an audience, I thought I would do some research. And then this is when you realize that it comes with a story. As you say, there are other people that have heard it, that it has traveled a specific journey. You always thought it's so personal that it's unrepeatable. And it is. That doesn't negate its personal qualities. I have performed the piece in cases where there have been Greeks or people of Greek origin in the audience, and I had people humming along. And this is also another interesting experience, because of course it's a loop and you sort of get entrained in that. It carries a value. It carries a value of its culture. And in a way, it also carries a value of the now moment of the culture, as it speaks to the past moment of the culture. I hear the recording now and I know it's wrong, but I keep it because this is how the piece was devised. I'm talking about my grandmother as an immigrant because this is roughly the translation of the term used in Greek, but she was a refugee, a war refugee. So for me, as I listened to this, and it struck me during performance why I avoided the term, why I didn't want to posit her as a refugee, why I used that other word, why do I keep that other word? And I don't have an answer. It has to do with linguistic ambiguity, but also there is a sense of, do I listen back and reconnect to that traumatic past in a moment which all the trauma associated with being a refugee is so prominent and so in excess? Perhaps it has to do with that. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, this is of course, yeah, very strong. Another layer in the piece is this relationship to a personal history, history of migration, the history of conflict. So it's also sort of surrounding the very personal quality, even how you share this lullaby, you share this recording. But at the same time, you also have this distance. Yeah, you address yourself indirectly. You kind of present to us this character, Konstantinos, and you know the narrative. So I'm also very struck by that, how you also show something very close, but also from this performative distancing. Or can you say something about that?
Yes, this is, because it's a performance lecture and there are Q&As, this is actually a point of contention. I have had very interesting discussions about the third person. That returns us to intentions of dramaturgs and reception of dramaturgs and how they intermingle. So the reason why, there are a few reasons why I chose the third person. I am sitting on stage when I perform and there is the tape recorder and you hear my grandmother from another speaker and all that. So the narrator is somebody else. Up to then you had me voicing or doing things. So it's clearly showing, okay, the narrator is somebody else. The second thing was, it's a sort of admitting to the listeners that I may have been presenting my vocal history, my vocal autobiography, inviting you to engage in tasks and think about your own vocal history, but it's performative, it's theatrical. I sort of say, first I had to devise the persona Konstantinos and choose what he wanted to narrate or share, because obviously mm-hmm. there are things that I don't want to share in a performance. And thirdly, it was slightly therapeutic to think of what has happened to him, because as I said, most of it is slightly comedic and energetic, but the scenes that precede that had to do with me growing up as a disfluent kid and then racism and how it was perceived sonically in sound. So I wanted to say, this is what happened to him. I want to take a moment to breathe. Now, a lot of people get that, and actually I had a few emails saying it was fascinating to think of myself and my voice in the third person because it was easier for me to understand things about my voice if I think of it in the third person. But I also had people saying, oh, in my culture, using the third person is rude. Or in my culture, the third person is used by the monarch or the oligarch. So, of course, this initiates a very interesting discussion about cultural background and what it does. Because where I come from, it doesn't connote that. Even in English, you say sort of one has to, and which is slightly the abstract, but normally it means I think like this. And yeah. Also because I studied French, I sort of have in my mind the on, which is sort of we, and I don't know how else to describe it. How did you feel about the third person, Brandon?
No, I think it's very effective because, again, it brought me back to this feeling of, again, the ways in which things that are so personal and so intimate and so defining ourselves often are actually something that is incredibly shared also. And there's a kind of ways in which our stories, the particularities of those stories also speak towards larger cultural historical stories. So I felt you positioning yourself in this third person was a nice play between, you know, the sentimentality of the work and the larger question that you point us to. So we're in a way asked to hear both these things, which I thought was really, really beautiful. And at the same time, I was also really, really curious about the ways in which you also unite your voice with your grandmother. We're also constantly hearing her as you're speaking or as the narrator is speaking, also through this tape recorder from your own past, you know, so it's another kind of historical layer. But I was struck about this duet that's going on.
That's a very interesting question, because it was there at the beginning and sort of disappeared as you perform something for a while. So it's great to bring it back to the forefront. At the time, because it's practices research, there were questions around selfhood and personhood and vocal development that informed the making of the piece. I was reading a lot about this dynamic between the personal and the cultural. I think it was in your book where you sort of talk about this idea that the personal and the very intimate, even the voice of conscience, is always contaminated by what you have heard, been told about your voice. So even internality cannot be thought of as separate of externality and vice versa. So one way is that, to think about this duet with grandmother. And the second thing is, I have been toying with this idea, and that's a dramaturgical device as well as a perhaps theoretical device, of the vocal assemblage, that as you voice, you might be thinking of your voice because you do a kind of reduction. Okay, here, here, Konstantinos's voice. But at the same time, you hear Brandon's silence or the way he will respond, and you hear the technology and you hear the devices. So it's always co-constituted, it's co-devised. Mm. Because it's so personal and it is my voice, and I also sing that lullaby, etc., etc., it has informed, I guess, my vocal development. I know it's internal, external, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. I really love this idea of the vocal assemblage. I think that's what you called it.
Yes.
Yes, this co-constitution. And maybe this takes us back a little bit to the earlier sort of reflection about the performativity of the voice being me and not me, being I and not I, the way in which the voice, you know, authenticates us. And it makes me think about Adriana Cavarero and her insistence on the voice giving a certain articulation to the uniqueness of oneself. You know, she really focuses on this question of uniqueness, that the voice is particularly able to forefront, you know, to bring forward. And, you know, I kind of, in a way, I always hesitate in her argument around that, because I sort of feel, again, going back to this idea of the vocal assemblage, you know, that the ways in which the voice, again, as you say, you know, reflects so much about things around, you know, our bodies, things around our subjectivities. And the voice, in a way, as you say, brings all these things together and assembles them. And so I sort of wonder, in a way, I wonder about this idea of uniqueness that she points us at, and if that's a really correct term, or if there's another way to think. I mean, I sort of appreciate what she's getting at, but I also hesitate around this idea of uniqueness.
I think it would be very interesting to have Adriana here, because I think she would definitely agree with you. I was at a conference, and I must admit that I know Adriana personally, and we have worked together, we have conducted interviews as well. There was a 70th celebration of her work, and there was a conference, and the very first thing she said when she went on stage was, please correct me, please tell me where I'm wrong, because this is how philosophy is done. So I think these days, because we have talked a little bit with Adriana about accent and about, of course, how this is not just the personal, it's also the political and the social, she does agree. The way I understand it is she comes to this idea of uniqueness from the perspective of a feminist discourse in the 80s and 90s. And I'm also thinking of bell hooks when she says, I'm going to talk back in order to find my own voice and listen to myself speak, where claiming a voice for certain minority groups is a process of saying that I am an individual worth of having a value. So I think Adriana, even at that conference, recognized that there is these perspectives that she didn't discuss. And my feeling is that she comes from that perspective of not uniqueness as assumed and posited, but for some minority groups as a claim to, which I think, the way I hear it, is exactly what you're saying. Because claiming a voice is a process that acknowledges the fact that you don't have one unique voice to begin with, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really, an important perspective, yeah, to hang on to and to remember, particularly if we think about many different examples, but currently all the different protests and activities that are emerging, particularly out of the United States, in which, you know, clearly there's a necessity not only to understand these voices as claiming a certain kind of agency, but also in a way demanding also that we hear them, you know? So there is also the flip side to that agency of the voice, which is also the ways in which listening also performs a certain kind of agency or participates in the claiming of that agency. And this is also something that I try to work at when I get into acoustic justice, which is also to say that, for instance, we may, you know, claim and argue for the freedom of speech, for instance, the right for free expression, all of which is so vital and so essential and so important. And at the same time, I'm really, really interested to think about the freedom of listening also as a right and how that right participates in that field of politics or in that field of agency.
Yes, I'm immediately thinking of current examples or even not current examples, because there's a long lineage of examples. The way you're perceived in sound can actually have material effects, as you say. If somebody posits through your sound your voice as worth being acknowledged as a living voice, right? Because you mentioned your project, and it's such a complex project, because you bring together notions of architecture and sound and orientation and politics and justice. I wonder, as we're drawing to the close of this discussion, are there any thoughts or perhaps an idea or an exercise to extend this podcast to leave our listeners with, related somehow to this, that you'd like to share?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't necessarily have a specific exercise or task, but I think maybe it can be, you know, within this discussion and within this larger project, which really talks about voice and orality, is to really think about listening, I think, as a position of agency. And so maybe it can be interesting, you know, to propose to others, you know, as they walk away from listening to us, to carry their listening with them back into daily life, into their contexts, and to just reflect a little bit upon how their listening is a form of enactment that impacts onto those around them. So again, to think oneself as a listener, as being a certain agent within one's environment, how you might perform listening in a more concerted effort.
I think I will try this a little bit more. Perhaps we can also ask our listeners, just extending exactly what you were saying, to make a list or be made more aware of the listening habits or listening circumstances that are currently rejigged or disrupted and how they feel about them. I'm thinking a lot of the time you hear the noisy neighbor and annoyed you, but now in an environment of enclosure, I love hearing that other people are there. So I'm thinking, what are the listening practices that you have changed or the change in values you assign to them?
Well, let's leave it at that. I think that's a good a good proposal.
Thank you very much, Brandon. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Thank you, Konstantinos.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Dano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.